this continuing education class. This is assessing the risk, interviewing, understanding, and managing suicidal and self-injurious clients. And I'm Kirk Woodring. I'm going to be your guide, facilitator. Okay, great. So let me talk a little bit about the day, set this up. We're going to start out looking at suicide prevalence and risk factors. I'll talk a little bit about statistics, the communities, individuals who are most at risk, and a little bit about why they're at risk. We'll take a break at 10:30 or so for 15 minutes. We'll come back. We'll start to look at assessment skills and tools that you can use for doing assessments. We'll have lunch. Depending on how much time we've been able to spend on the assessment tools, we may come back and finish up on that after lunch. If we've done well with that, we'll go into doing a sort of a psychological autopsy of a case and look at the process of suicide and what we might have done as clinicians if we had been involved. Specifically, the individual we'll be talking about is Kurt Cobain, who is a lead singer for Nirvana. We'll take another break at 2:30 or so. We'll come back. We'll actually look at suicide notes and kind of do an analysis in groups on those suicide notes. Again, what would you do? What tools would you use if you were to have a client who had made an attempt or who had written this note and you were aware of that? Right, and then we'll end with questions that you might have. These are the objectives. Hopefully by the end of this day, you'll have a better understanding of how to interview, how to assess for risk. I'll give you some tools, how to ask questions, to do a rapid risk assessment. We'll be using some material from a book that I wrote with Sharon Chappett, who's a nurse. We wrote a book called Assessing the Risk. Suicidal Behavior in the Hospital Environment of Care. And it's really geared towards emergency departments and towards folks who are working in medical facilities. But the interviewing skills and techniques are really transferable to any location. We'll also be using some of Sean Shea's work. Sean Shea is a psychiatrist in New Hampshire. He's written extensively on suicidal behavior and assessing for suicide risk, so we'll involve some of his material. You'll have a better understanding of high-risk behavior and sort of how to look at the statistical risk factors, both in what creates suicidal behavior and what factors help prevent suicidal behavior. What are some of the strengths that folks bring to, and resiliency that people can bring to managing their suicide risk? Legal and treatment issues we'll talk a little bit about. We'll talk about documentation and the importance of documentation and how to document well when you're doing a risk assessment. That's becoming more and more critically important. I'm sure all of you are aware if you're involved in any kind of practice. The importance of documenting and documenting for risk particularly. And then we'll give you some resources. I'll give you some resources for managing suicidality and some tools, give you an evaluation that you can use, kind of an assessment tool that you can use. And so that's kind of how we'll do the process for the day. At any point in time, I really want this to be interactive. One of the things I really can't stand is when I'm just standing up here talking. So please, at any point in time, if you have a question, if you have a comment, if you have a thought, bring it forward. I'm really interested in hearing about personal experiences that you might have had with clients or others who are suicidal or who attempted suicide or who committed suicide. It's really important for us to kind of make that live in the room because it really is so critical that people hear the stories about suicide. I'm curious about how many people here have been affected in some way by suicide. So that's, the majority of the class. So it's so prevalent and for so many years was really dismissed and not talked about. And I want to be able to talk about it and make it real in here. So feel free to jump in. So what can you expect? This is going to be a difficult day, or it can be a difficult day. This is a difficult topic. There's a tremendous amount of stigma attached to suicide. If you've been if you've been involved in a suicide in any way, shape, or form, you've been touched by that. And so when we talk about suicidal behavior, when we talk about the effect of suicide, when we talk about depression, we start to kind of take on some of those feelings, the depression, the anhedonia. I really want to try to avoid that if we can. So at any point in time, if you need to take a break, even if it's not break time, feel free to do that. Get up, stretch, walk around, go outside. One of the things that's important to do is drink water. Not only because it's hot out there, but because as you become more and more sort of activated by what we might be discussing, drink some water. It helps kind of flush your system out. So, you know, ask questions. You might feel like you don't understand what we're discussing, or you might feel like you're really sort of lost. Don't be afraid to ask questions at all. There are no wrong questions at all. And the more we discuss this, the more we talk with each other, I think the better we'll understand the topic. All right. One of the things that I will be doing is in the process of the course today, I'll be going over and queuing up some YouTube videos. I've taken a lot of material from YouTube that sort of helps inform this process. And there are times I've found, especially more recently, that YouTube videos love to have ads at the beginning of them, and you usually have to wait 3 or 4 seconds at least before you can shut the ad down. So please, you know, don't pay attention to the ad. We'll click off on it when we can and move forward. So I did a Google search yesterday. I just typed in how to commit suicide. There were 23,100,000 results. Right? And, you know, interestingly, one of the first ones is the veteranscrisisline.net, thinking of suicide. It's an ad. I was heartened by that fact. That was a good thing. But then as you go down, you get all sorts of how to commit suicide painlessly, cocktails to use for suicide. If someone is thinking about suicide right now, they have resources available to them beyond belief in terms of information that didn't exist even 10 years ago. I did the same search, I think, in 2006, and there were somewhere around 1 million results. So we've gone 23 times that number in just a few years. So people have access to information when they're feeling suicidal about how to commit suicide, and not quite so much about how to prevent suicide. That's where we come in. How do we help folks prevent suicide? How do we assess when someone is feeling suicidal and maybe they don't want to talk about it? Maybe they don't want to let you know, or maybe they're afraid of letting you know that they're feeling suicidal. So today we're really going to try to figure out ways to get into developing that relationship with the client quickly to assess for risk, and looking at some validity techniques to get the best answers, the best information from them. And in some ways, we kind of have to be detectives to do that. So, all right. In the past 5 years, 60% of all suicides were committed with firearms. It's not really surprising. We'll talk about this in different forms throughout the day today, but firearms are obviously the most lethal method for suicide. So so if somebody is going to make an attempt with a firearm, they're more likely to be successful. In the US, one person completed suicide every 18 minutes. Most individuals didn't want to die, they just wanted to get rid of the pain that they were experiencing. So folks who commit suicide, as you may know, as you may experience, are often in tremendous pain. It may be physical pain, it may be psychological or emotional pain. And in most cases, they don't want to die, but they want to end the pain. And the pain is so unremitting and so difficult that the only way out in their minds is to end it with suicide. And oftentimes, and we'll talk more about this later on as well, there's an element, especially with folks who are chronically suicidal, who have attempted many times, of self-loathing. It's not just depression. It's this sort of intense self-loathing that creates that kind of pain. Suicidal crises typically tend to be brief. So if you can intervene in the suicidal crisis, you can save that person's life. So the idea is to be able to put in an intervention in place, jump in at a time when the crisis is happening so that you can get that person help and get them safe. Hospitalizing somebody on an inpatient psychiatric unit keeps them safe. It doesn't necessarily decrease their suicidality, but for the period of time that they're in there, they're safe. And during that time, the hope is that they're going to get the assistance and the support and the attention that they need to help them decrease their suicidality. Intervening in the crisis, getting them help, intensive help. Maybe it's a partial hospitalization program. Maybe it's something that's going to hold them, even family support, to get them over the crisis can be really helpful. So what are some of the specific suicide risks in certain conditions? So one wouldn't be surprised that a high number of individuals who attempt suicide have had previous attempts. In fact, it's one of the primary factors in determining risk is that previous attempt at suicide. So 38.4% of suicides are completed by folks who have had previous attempts. You can see going down the line here, you have a mix of other Axis 1 and Axis 2 concerns. Drug abuse, alcohol abuse, all are involved in kind of creating a risk picture. So when you're doing an assessment, one of the things that you want to do is elicit those risk factors. What are the risk factors that the individual is coming up with? And you may know that because you've got a history with them. You've been working with them for some time in therapy or in the school. But if you're a crisis clinician, you may not have that experience. If you're a nurse or a doctor or a social worker in a hospital, you may not have that relationship. So what we'll work on today is really figuring out those ways to tease out that information. How do you get good information about the risk factors when the individual might be challenged to tell you that, right? For a variety of reasons. It may be because of their mental status, intoxication. It may be just their resistance to informing you. It may be their willingness to really engage in an active suicidal plan. Alcohol, you know, it's interesting. Alcohol abuse actually, as a risk rate, is only 5.86%. Alcohol abuse alone is not necessarily a risk factor. Alcohol abuse in combination with any of these others is an exacerbating factor. So someone who is depressed and using alcohol, their risk rates go up significantly, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Someone who's depressed and using other drugs, any kind of combination of risk factors exacerbate that risk. Okay. Alcohol use as a primary factor is not as great a risk rate. There's another slide in a few minutes about that. And you know what happens is that somebody comes to you with a number of risk factors, And if they're using alcohol or if they're using substances that impair their judgment, then the likelihood of their being successful or actually attempting suicide goes way up. So somebody who's feeling depressed and is drinking alcohol, their impulse control lessens, right, is weakened. Their judgment is impaired, and it becomes much easier to actually make that attempt. It happens with other clients as well, substance abusing clients, alcohol dependent clients. How much autonomy do they have in making poor decisions for themselves, right? The case of an anorexic client, an eating disorder client, a severe eating disorder client, or a severe alcohol dependent client, you can make the case they're committing suicide, right? They're slowly, failing to eat themselves to death. They're slowly drinking themselves to death. They have the capacity to do that, the capability to do that. In some ways, they're even more difficult to intervene with because it's a slow process. I think the suicidal client that comes in with a plan, they can give us a little bit more information and activate us to get them help more quickly. Now, are we intervening and taking away their right to commit suicide? Well, I don't know. Does somebody have a right to commit suicide? I mean, legally, it's murder, right? So it is an ethical dilemma, and I always tend to err on the side of getting somebody the kind of support and help that will get them through that crisis, with the hope that getting them through that crisis will then, allow them to develop some resiliency so that they don't continue to experience, these suicidal thoughts. Move them on. Now, I mean, clearly, and I didn't say this at the beginning, I really should have. I think of suicide and suicidal behavior as being, in some cases, a chronic illness, right? And there are times that no matter what our intervention is, we can't save the patient, right? It's like cancer. It's like any other chronic illness that could end up being fatal. There are things, as much as we put in place, as much as we want to save that patient, we can't do it, right? So, and someone who is absolutely determined and convinced that they are going to commit suicide will not let you help them. And I think that's one of the most challenging things as a clinician to face, to be able to, to be reaching out. It's like a doctor who's, an oncologist who has that medicine and knows what the treatment protocol is and knows how to save that patient, and the patient dies. It does happen. And so I will frame this often as I can only do what I can do. I can only do as much as I can do, and the person who I'm working with, that client, has to be willing to engage in that process with me. And if they're not, it's not likely that they're going to be able to be saved. That's the parallel to, other medical illnesses. Right. Cancer is a great one. 5 years from now, will there be better treatment for managing suicidal behavior? We don't know. There are treatments now. Medication does not necessarily work well in specifically decreasing suicidal ideation, except lithium is one that does. But you're right. I mean, what's next, and what would happen if we could save somebody until they get to that point? That's a good question. I mean, it's one of those gray areas, and it kind of gets to the point of how much. How much of this is privileged information from your client, and how much is your determination that they are at such high risk that they need intervention immediately. I mean, in Massachusetts, we have the ability to involuntarily commit somebody to an evaluation. I think that's used a lot. I don't know if it's, I know when I ran a crisis team, it was used a lot. We would go, the police would pick somebody up who we were very concerned about, just given the information that we received. Clearly, we get into ethical dilemmas around this. I mean, I remember when I was a new clinician, and working with an agency where, you know, I was not actually working with this particular client, but consulted on this case. It was an older gentleman who had AIDS. He was sort of at the end stage of his illness. He was facing possible prison time for a crime he committed. He was going to trial. And he let it be known to his caseworker that he planned on committing suicide. And, you know, and he had a plan, he had means, and there was a lot of question about, you know, we know that, do we allow that to happen? And, you know, there was a lot of discussion. Ultimately, we did call the police, ultimately they did intervene, but he did end up committing suicide at another time. So I do think that somebody who is reaching out to talk about their suicidal behavior or their suicidality, their thoughts, that's the entree into getting them some assistance. It's the folks that don't talk about it at all that really create a world that insulates them and isolates them from others around their suicidality that we get particularly concerned about. So if somebody's talking about it, that's the first step. That's a good thing. You know, they want to get some help in most cases. Did I see some, were there other questions? Okay. So just in terms of suicide rates among persons 10 years and older, and somebody said, you know, I work in an elementary school. We don't really see suicide. Probably not as much, but it does happen. And the CDC starts tracking suicides at the age of 10. So, but you can see, you know, non-Hispanic whites per 100,000, somewhere around 26. Non-Hispanic blacks, around 12. Hispanics, a little higher. Native Americans, the highest risk rate in the country for suicide, and Asian and Pacific individuals around 10%. So this is a map of suicide rates around the country. Actually, the CDC, the first map I used, the CDC had it as red and blue as the colors, which is prior to the elections. This is back in the late 1990s, and they changed it because, interestingly, the red states had the higher suicide rates. The blue states had the lower suicide rates. But take a look at this map and tell me what's interesting about it to you. What do you notice? Poverty and isolation. Isolation. You think about the middle of the country. Vast areas without necessarily resources, gun availability, huge, absolutely. Firearm access and the laws restricting or not restricting firearms is one of the most important considerations in suicide risks. So if you think about, you know, the Rockies, Alaska, Florida, the Appalachian states, higher suicide rates, less restrictive gun laws, right? So again, someone who attempts suicide with a firearm is much more likely to be successful than someone who attempts with strangulation or with poisoning. Okay? So American Indian population, Native American population is, again, in the middle of the country, the middle western part of the country, so you have higher rates of suicide. We don't know what's happening in this, you know, in this area or over here in terms of reporting. Remember, this is CDC information. So, you know, are these counties that don't report to the CDC, and why don't they report to the CDC? Right? Is it, you know, what's the reason for that? Anything else? There's one other factor here that I think is sort of interesting. Alaska has the highest rate of suicide. Alaska and Nevada, interestingly. Alaska has the highest rate of suicide. In the Northeast, especially Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, high rates of suicide. What's it like in the winter? Right? This part of the country up here, it's dark, right, for much of the day. People are more isolated. There's snow, so people stay inside. They can't get out. The rates of alcohol and other substance abuse is much higher in these northern states, and in Alaska and in Nevada, actually, too. It's really through the roof. So the combination, again, of factors leads to an increased suicide risk. So if you're living in Oklahoma, you're paying attention to some of those factors that, you know, are just basic factors that exist in the culture and in the community that increase risk. If you're living in Florida, you're thinking about what are the factors that increase risk. Access to guns, age of Floridians is greater than the general population. Older adults have a much higher, especially older men, much higher rate of suicide. In fact, men over the age of 65 have, I think, the highest rate of suicides of any group. Men over the age of 65, all men, white men included, very high rates. Right? Now, interestingly, the rate of death among those individuals, suicide doesn't show up as being even in the top 10 because they're dying of other things. So when you look at like the CDC statistics, you see older adults and the suicide rate compared to other causes of death is way down. But when you compare suicide rates to others, the rates are very, very high, much higher. So these kinds of factors are really important to consider. Demographic factors are important to consider. Where you're practicing, access to resources. If you're practicing in Boston, you have hospitals all around you that can be, hopefully, helpful. You have emergency services that can be helpful. If you're practicing in North Dakota, probably not so much. Overall, leading causes of death in 2009, suicide, number 10, I think, right here. Higher than HIV, higher than homicide, a lot higher than homicide, higher than liver disease, hypertension. And this is just overall, in the United States. Trends in suicide rates among people ages 25 to 64 by both sexes, age group, from 1991 to 2009. You can see that it started to drop a little bit here. Between 1991 and 1999, suicide rates began to level off and drop even. And then around 1999, 2000, we started to see an increase in suicide rates. And particularly in the 45 to 54-year-olds, you can see from 2002 to 2009, they really started to go up. And I can tell you that the more recent data that the CDC has put out, this is continuing to climb. Because what happened in 2008? Anybody remember?
The economy
crashed, right? So suicide rates, especially among that 35 to 54-year-old group, began to go up. People started losing their houses. They started losing their jobs. Their identity was tied into the work they did or who they believed they were as a result of that. And so you began to see suicide rates go up. Mechanism of suicides, sort of interesting. Males and females, men, by and large, over 55% of suicides are by firearm. So men are more successful at suicides, but attempt less often. Women, less successful, but attempt more often, primarily because they use a less lethal method. So women, in 30% of the cases, use a firearm, men 55%. Women are more likely to use poisoning as a means of suicide, poisoning being overdosing typically on medication, stockpiling medication to use. It's an interesting thing about stockpiling medication. People didn't really think about it so much as being a means for suicide or even a question to ask about suicide. But what has happened over time, especially I think with how we sort of manage and monitor pharmaceuticals, insurance companies managing and monitoring pharmaceuticals, is that people will just naturally begin to hold out some medication when they are almost at the end of their meds. So I don't know if this happens to you, but if somebody will have a 90-day supply of medication, and when they get down to those last couple of weeks, they're ordering a new supply, and they're going to save that medication out, primarily because if they lose their insurance, they want to make sure that they have medication. So they stockpile it as a way of making sure that they have that resource for managing their medical concern at home, easily accessible. But if they become suicidal, or as they become more suicidal, that becomes a ready-made opportunity for them to use that stockpile of medication for suicide. And that's something that's changed in the last 5 or 6 years. So people are much more likely to be stockpiling medication, not because they're suicidal, but because they want to make sure that they have that medication available to them. And it's there then available as a means for suicide, as a method for suicide. If you're not aware, Tylenol is the most lethal means, really, of non-prescription medications for suicide. It's easily accessible, and you're right. You can get a bottle of 500, right? Two. You can buy as many as you want, right? Yeah. What Tylenol does in high amounts over a fairly rapid period of time after ingestion is that it begins to cause liver failure. And so that's why you almost see these kind of black box warnings that Tylenol puts out about only use the dose that's recommended on the bottle. Because if you take more than that, if you take a lot more than that, it can become very lethal very quickly. I had a really tragic situation that I was involved with as a crisis clinician one time. We had a 16-year-old girl who was brought into the emergency department who had broken up with her boyfriend. She was a good student, had a solid family, but she was devastated by this breakup. She took an entire bottle of Tylenol, ingested an entire bottle of Tylenol, before she went to bed. She didn't get sick, slept through the night, woke up the next morning, felt sick, told her parents got her to the emergency department. She was then moved to another medical facility and ultimately died over the course of 3 days. She didn't want to die. She wanted to do something to get rid of the pain. She wanted to make a statement. Right, but she waited too long to get help, and so that's something that it really is important when you're asking questions: is what kind of when you take a headache, what kind of medication do you typically use? When you're in pain, what kind of medication do you typically use? How do you be thinking about someone's access to Tylenol? I'm not sure everybody that attempts suicide goes on the internet to look at what's going to be most successful. I think people that are really doing a lot of planning do. But someone who's in crisis is going to go for the first thing that they can find. Or even if they're in a sort of a protracted crisis over a period of days, they're going to be building up ideas on their own. They're not necessarily going to be looking for ideas from other folks. But, I mean, clearly that's some evidence that restricting access can, has a powerful effect. Restricting access to firearms has a powerful effect. I'm not saying that, politically I'm not making a statement there, but I'm saying clinically it has an effect when you restrict access to a method of suicide, the likelihood is, you know, people are not going to commit suicide. There's, you know, the big discussion in San Francisco about putting up barriers or fencing over the Golden Gate Bridge. Because the Golden Gate Bridge is it's the most jumped off of bridge in the country. And there's actually a really interesting movie called The Bridge, about suicides off of the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge. And there's a lot of tension politically around doing that. But when it's been done in other locations, suicide rates have dropped almost to zero. So if you prevent the suicide, the ability, the means for the suicide, then suicide rates drop. And often people don't go to some other method. Somebody who's committed to jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge sort of they have an image of their suicide in a certain way. And they're less likely to probably take an overdose of Tylenol, right? It also allows some time for that intervention to take place and to get them help. So racial and ethnic disparities, we talked a little bit about this with Native Americans, American Indians, Alaskan Natives. But ages 15 to 34, suicide is the second leading cause of death for that group. Suicide rates among American Indian, Alaskan Native, adolescents, and young adults is 2.2 times higher than the national average for that age group. Hispanic female high school students in grades 9 to 12 reported a higher percentage of suicide attempts, 14%, than their white non-Hispanic or black non-Hispanic counterparts. So 14% of female high school, Latina high school students reported suicide attempts. That's pretty high. You think 14 out of 100, right, are reporting that they've had a suicide attempt. So just take a quick look at this video here. Among young adults, 15 to 24, there's one suicide for every 100 to 200 attempts. Among adult ages 65 years and older, there's one suicide for every 4 suicide attempts. Any thoughts about why that might be the case? Why are there, why is someone who's 15 to 24 successful, only 1 in 100 to 200 times, and why is someone who's older successful 1 out of every 4 times? That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. They're less likely to reach out and get and have supports around them. Yeah. So what happens is when people are younger is they practice, right? Practice at everything. You learn to get better. Your commitment to suicide as you get older, as you practice more, becomes you're better at it. You also learn what does and doesn't work. So somebody, as people age, they're more likely to use lethal methods, and they're more likely to be committed to the act. It's less an impulsive act. It's less about, getting attention, and more about actually committing the act itself. Facebook. We'll talk about adolescence a little bit more, but I don't want to let this go. Social media sort of the intensity of social media. I have a 14-year-old and a 17-year-old daughter, and I'm amazed at their connection to other people while they're sitting on the couch, right? So they have Facebook, they have Instagram, they have Twitter. Facebook isn't even cool anymore, apparently. Unless you're my age, right? It's all Twitter, all Instagram. That social media has its pluses and minuses, right? Facebook actually has a policy that they screen for anything that they perceive to be a suicide message. And they have technology to do that, but it sends a message to that person with information about getting help, which may or may not be helpful, But what I have seen, even just recently in the last year, is such an increase in the number of young people posting notes, suicide notes, on Facebook or online on Twitter, or talking in detail about their suicide plans in those areas, and sometimes without being able to get help. So I'm thinking of one, actually there were two situations recently, one in my town, another in a town north of where I live, where high school students posted on Facebook that they just couldn't manage any longer. And in both cases, people saw those notes within 15 minutes and tried to reach out, but it was too late. Both of the girls were successful at committing suicide. And the sort of the devastation for the community of people who read those notes and, you know, would have wanted to do something or wanted to reach out was you know, amazing. So it's important to really be paying attention to how people use social media. How do they get information and access information? One of the things that social media promotes, not, you know, manifestly, but it, just as social media, is the opportunity for those sort of copycat incidents, right? What you see is that group contagion effect. And that's especially true in high schools, but it's absolutely true in colleges as well. There's a dynamic that occurs in a successful suicide, then sort of decreases the stigma and the resistance to future suicides. So if someone has been thinking about suicide and they see that somebody else is successful, and they see all of the kind of drama that plays out as a result of that, it's encouraging them to move on their thoughts. For celebrities, that's true, but it's also true for, you know, just our young children, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-olds in schools. When someone that commits suicide that may not even be well-known to anybody outside their peer group, then becomes idealized and sort of, canonized. And again, it's that drama can kind of really feed into, for some folks, that wish to make the attempt themselves. Right. And if you think about the community response, what would the community response be if those were three homicides in the school in the course of a month or 2 months, right? It would be a different, probably, response. Right, and I think as a clinician, you have to recognize that you can only do everything that you can do, right? And you know, once you've sort of discharged as much of that responsibility as you can, and you know, try to reach out, then that's really, you know, that's all you can do. But it is really good learning for that client. It's a really good opportunity to use that as a lesson for that client about engaging in listening to that and being responsive to that. Yeah, it's amazing, especially in middle school and high school, but middle school particularly is what I've noticed. The talking about suicide, the talking about death, wanting to die. I mean, there's a developmental component to that. But there's a lot of sharing of information around thoughts of suicide. I don't think as a clinician, I don't think asking questions about suicide will cause the person to become suicidal, right? We need to ask those questions about suicide. I do think that, young teens talking about suicide starts to stir up thoughts of suicide, and the more it gets talked about, the more it gets discussed, the more the risk increases for attempts, not necessarily successes, but for attempts, because it sort of, you create this, again, this sort of group contagion effect. We talk about it, we attempt, somebody else attempts, more people attempt. It becomes almost, well, it's a lot like, and we'll talk about non-suicidal self-injurious behavior like cutting. Cutting, there's a real contagion effect with cutting in schools. Once it gets talked about and people start to do it, you see it becoming almost an epidemic, especially in middle schools. So, and actually I've seen it in elementary schools as well. So, but we'll talk about that. Gender disparities, we've talked a little bit about this already. Men take their lives nearly four times the rate of females. They represent almost 80% of all suicides in the United States. Among males, adult ages 75 and older, they're the highest rate of suicide, 37.97, almost 40 per 100,000. You think about, 7 per 100,000 of teens. So you can see that it's a significantly greater rate of suicides. Females, those in their 40s and 50s, had the highest rates of suicide. We talked about firearms and poisoning. You know, okay, so I've got a 47-year-old recently divorced woman that I'm working with. You know, I want to be asking some questions about what's happening in her life. And, maybe she's not suicidal. Probably isn't. But I want to begin to kind of dig a little bit to find out what might be happening that would lead her to be suicidal. What are the other risk factors that exist besides the age and maybe the recent divorce? All right. So almost 375,000 people were treated in emergency departments for self-inflicted injuries. 165,000 people were hospitalized due to self-inflicted injuries, and there's one suicide for every 25 attempted suicides. If you think about this, the almost 375,000 people in 2005 coming into emergency departments for self-inflicted injuries, those weren't necessarily all suicide attempts, but many of them, most of them probably were. If you're getting emergency department treatment, it's probably, for a self-inflicted injury, it's probably because there was some suicidality involved. People who are non-suicidal and self-injurious typically don't get to the point where they actually reach the emergency department. They don't cut that deep. They don't burn that much. So you can imagine that that cohort is probably that's probably a group of people who were attempting suicide. And when you look at death rates by suicide, I think it's important to kind of take that with a little bit of a caveat in that there are areas, places in the country that won't, the medical examiner or the coroner won't necessarily identify it as a suicide. For what reasons? Cultural, religious, small community insurance, small community. If there's an opportunity for that individual to call it an accidental death, right? They may be more likely to do that. Larger cities, it's less likely that that's going to happen. But in small communities, which account for a large percentage of the United States, those medical examiners and coroners are part of the community and maybe less likely to actually, if there's a way to identify that suicide as something other than a suicide, they may be more likely to do that. So the stigma of suicide really does still determine, in many cases, how suicide is identified on death certificates. So something important to kind of remember. So this is something that I think about all the time when I'm thinking about suicidality. And I actually heard this when I was working with some folks at hospice. And this was sort of how they defined what causes somebody to become suicidal. So when an individual's intolerance for the intensity of the stress and pain they're experiencing exceeds their capacity and resources to overcome the problem. So someone is in so much pain or the stress that they're experiencing psychologically is so great that it exceeds the resources that exist for them to overcome their problem, right? That captures a lot. You think about medical issues, you think about psychological stress, loss, grief, the stress that's related to losses, economic losses. When the housing market crashed and people were, their houses were being foreclosed on, suicide rates in those communities went up significantly. So the stress and the intensity of the stress or the intensity of the pain exceeds the resources to overcome that pain. So when you're meeting with somebody, and you're hearing kind of the pain that they're in, it's important to look at, okay, well, what are the resources that you have or exist to manage that pain? Are you using resources to help you manage that stress or that pain? And if you're not, let's find what the resources are that can help you, okay? Because we want to have resources that exceed the stress. We want to have resources that exceed the pain. I used an example in my book of a patient I was working with who was in chronic pain, and she always was looking for and actually thinking she could find the next best thing to get her out of that chronic pain, right? And she went through every medical practitioner that she could find, and non-traditional practitioners, and there was one individual who really, there was a trial that they were doing, a doctor that was doing a trial, and they thought that they could get her into it and she'd be a perfect candidate, and she was very excited about that because she had been in chronic pain for years. She goes to the doctor, meets with the doctor, and finds out that she's not a candidate for the trial. And she, at that point, felt that the resources were non-existent to manage her chronic pain and became very suicidal. And so, folks who have that sense that they're never going to get better, that the pain's never, it's unremitting, they will be the ones that are most at risk. It's interesting because PTSD is, I'll tell you what I think anyway. I think PTSD is sort of all-encompassing, and it's in some ways, the way that it's coded would be around some of the behaviors that are consistent with PTSD. So, even sort of psychotic episodes could be consistent with someone who's having, who's experiencing post-traumatic stress. So I'm not sure that it's well diagnosed, and I think when this came out, that information came out, it wouldn't necessarily have been identified as a primary risk factor for...
But even specifically with veterans?
Now, with veterans, it's a different thing. We're going to talk about veterans in a minute. But that particular cohort... clearly has become one of the primary risk populations, and PTSD is being talked about more, particularly with that group. PTSD is being talked if you look at the new DSM, stress-related disorders have a whole new all-encompassing realm within the DSM. But PTSD. In the general population is less likely to be seen as being a primary risk factor, but the what people experience as a result of the PTSD, that becomes risky, right? So, but we will talk about PTSD and particularly with veterans in a second.
It's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard that before, but not often. And it's, you think of in bipolar illness, that it's coming out of that manic episode into depression where the suicide rate is the highest. And probably statistically that is true. But there is that sort of interesting euphoria, right? And people talk about, there are people who kind of experience that euphoric reverie around suicidality, right? They, when they attempt suicide, they experience that euphoria. So that's interesting. I haven't read any research about that. We have to remember as clinicians that they're under the influence of their illness, right, at that time. Yeah. And what seems to be clarity and peace to them, and what feels peace to them, is also part of their illness. And what's next for them in that process? And And it is very, I think it's very difficult. Well, it's very difficult to get a depressed person out of their depression, out of their anhedonia, to get to the point where they see that they don't, you know, they shouldn't be committing suicide. They shouldn't commit suicide. I think it's even more difficult to get somebody who's out of that euphoric state where they feel at peace and they feel like they have clarity out of the place where they feel committed to suicide. A couple more things about suicidality and folks who are suicidal. 90% of suicides are by individuals who have a significant mental illness at the time of death. So it's not just alcoholism, right? It's bipolar disorder. It's schizophrenia. It's depression. It's any number of other diagnoses. Borderline personality disorder. So 90% of folks who commit suicide have a significant illness at the time of death. Now, whether or not they're being treated well is another question, right? When there's a co-occurring substance abuse, that significantly increases the risk. So again, the combination of a primary mental illness and a co-occurring substance abuse or alcohol dependence or abuse significantly increases the risk factors. Research, especially more recently, has shown that when there is kind of open psychomotor aggression in patients that have been previously depressed, and a sort of overt change in their clinical status, that is an indicator that there's a high likelihood that they'll be more likely to be suicidal. Any thoughts on why that might be the case? There's a couple of reasons for that. But. So they're more activated. Use the warnings on Prozac, especially in adolescence. So the sort of negative symptoms of the depression, what happens is that you get these the ability to be less energic. So, right, the energia goes away, but the anhedonia doesn't. So you become more, you have the ability and the energy to act on the thoughts. And so with SSRIs, particularly, the energy comes back before the anhedonia disappears, right? The other thing is that for some folks who are depressed or who may appear depressed and have been contemplating suicide, when they make the decision to commit suicide, they get that sort of euphoria, the peace that comes with that. When they've really made the commitment to follow through, there's this period of time before they act on that their depression seems to lift, that they appear to be less depressed, they have more energy, they may be more motivated to put things in place and to resolve problems for those around them, so that when they die, they know that they're not going to be leaving people with bills, unpaid bills, or things that they might have not followed through on previously. About 50% of people who kill themselves have seen their PCP in the past 2 months. The primary care clinician, their doctor, nurse practitioner, PA, they've seen them in the past 2 months. Up until recently, the medical field, the non-psychiatric medical field, hasn't done a great job of asking questions about depression or about suicide in an appointment, in a regular appointment, so a physical or a checkup, a med check. In the last few years, I don't know if you've noticed, but when you go to your doctor, you're probably going to get a question, at least some question, about depression or about thoughts of suicide or just about whether you're feeling hopeless or not, right? More and more, the medical field is paying attention to the fact that people coming in to see their doctors actually may be experiencing depression or other mental illness and having symptoms of thoughts of suicide. And so I know that particularly with pediatricians in the state of Massachusetts, they're asking. There's a screening process that they go through in asking adolescents and children questions around depression, and the Department of Mental Health in the state pays for consultation with a child psychiatrist if they have concerns. So they can call a child psychiatrist who's on call and get some assistance with either medication or referrals. And so that's, you know, that's a step in the right direction. This is a study that's been around for a long time. One study, 58% had seen their psychiatrist the previous week. So well over half had seen their psychiatrist. Now that's sort of interesting, right? You think about what is psychiatry now? Med management, right? Every 15 minutes, four times an hour, in and out. You know, I think being a psychiatrist is a challenge right now for folks who were trained, especially folks who were trained years ago as sort of psychoanalytic psychiatrists. It's difficult to do that work. And so the expectation is you're going to see the patient, you're going to check their medication, you're going to get them on the right medication, and then they're going to leave. You really don't have a lot of time to be engaged in the relationship with them to help really tease out what might be happening. So, you know, economic factors certainly come into play. And if you're a client and you know you've only got 15 minutes with your doc, you're probably going to be careful about how much you open up to him or her. Right? How successful is the treatment? And people are engaged in treatment and continue to be engaged in treatment that may not be really very successful, but what else is there? And in some ways, in some instances, people stay engaged in treatment because they don't know, is there anything else that's going to help them? Is this the best that it gets? And again, at some point, if they feel hopeless that the treatment is helping them or is going anywhere, then there's a likelihood that that hopelessness will lead towards suicidality. And, again, it's psychiatry is no different than any other medical treatment. You stay engaged, people with chronic back pain stay engaged in treatment, even though the treatment might not be working, or it even might be making them worse. They might get temporary remission from their pain, but the long-term consequences of the medication that they're using opens up all sorts of other issues. So I think that's sort of it's an interesting statement to make. If they're engaged in treatment, then that alone is a sign of hope. It is to some extent, but it also you do have to gauge how effective the treatment is. Right? So I want to talk a little bit about veterans for a minute, and I want to show a couple of news clips. Now these news clips are a couple of years old. I think they're still relevant though. So let me just set this up real quick. This is a story about a veteran, a soldier from this area, from this region, who committed suicide a few years ago. Really kind of rocked the community because both of his parents were involved in mental health services and substance abuse services. So they were aware of the kinds of problems that exist. And it really highlights, I think, issues around access and around doing good assessment. Now, I know that we don't have, obviously, all the story there, but given sort of what you heard, here's this Marine back from Iraq, drinking heavily, experiencing symptoms of PTSD probably, gets committed to a VA hospital, and there's no documentation that he sees a psychiatrist in the 3 days that he's there. What do you think's missing in that, right? I'm not pointing out the problems at the VA necessarily, because I think it's true in every hospitalization situation now. In these brief hospitalizations, often people don't get the attention, even in a locked psychiatric unit, that they need to help them get stable. Which is one of the reasons I said at the very beginning, being hospitalized does not necessarily in and of itself decrease your likelihood of suicide, right? And there's plenty of research that shows that. But, you know, from many different perspectives, from a legal perspective, an ethical perspective, a clinical perspective, it's really important that we learn how to do really good risk assessments and then document those assessments. Because in this case, the VA opens itself up to huge liability legally, right, for not documenting whether or not an assessment was done. So I'll talk about that, and that's one of the things I'm going to really kind of point out consistently is the importance of documenting your assessment, because if you do an assessment, that's great, but unless you make sure that it's written in a record someplace, you open yourself up for liability. So who becomes suicidal? Most people have suicidal thoughts sometime during their lives, often during teenage years. I did. I think probably all of my friends did. I can't think of anybody that doesn't, really, or most people do, have some thoughts about dying as teenagers. Now, interestingly, we'll talk about teenagers in a minute in terms of their risk factors and their being a high-risk population. But one of the things that's certainly true about adolescents is that their brains are not fully developed, right? That they have that teenage brain. I said I have two teenage daughters. I understand teenage brain pretty well right now, especially with my 14-year-old. You know, their way of thinking is very narcissistic. They're kind of self-centered and egocentric in their perspectives. There's this, you know, developmental rapprochement going back to sometimes I think back to 4 years old in terms of sort of the concrete nature of how they think. That concreteness, the concretization of thought, is one of the reasons that makes them high risk. It's the if, then, or when this happens, then this will happen. It's that black and white thinking that exists often. You know, when I was in high school, I had a friend who got himself into trouble playing cards. He owed somebody $100. He could not imagine how he was going to pay that money back. Didn't have it. And if he told his father would be very upset and ground him. So his response to that was to commit suicide. Now, this is a guy who is 15 years old, who owed $100 on a gambling debt and ended his life as a result. That's not really clearly thinking through the consequences of the action, right? It's based on what's right in front of him, you know, in the next day or two. And this was not somebody who was depressed. Family was a challenging family, but he didn't recognize or wasn't aware of resources that might have been available to help him and did not have, because of that sort of self-centered behavior, the ability to go out and ask for help. So adolescence is a tough time. Most suicidal ideation is fleeting. When you get help, it passes, right? That's where the crisis, if you intervene at the crisis, you can get help. 2007, 14.5% of students grade 9 through 12 considered suicide in the previous 12 months, and 18.7% of females did. 6.9% of students reported making at least one suicide attempt in the previous 12 months, and 2% of students reported making at least one suicide attempt in the previous 12 months that required medical attention. So you think about that. 7% of students reported making at least one suicide attempt in the previous 12 months. One in every seven students, high school students, made at least one suicide attempt. And seven in every 10, or seven in every 100, and two in every 100 admitted that they made attempts that required medical attention. So 2 out of 100, that seems high to me. I mean, that, you know, that's a lot of kids. In a high school, you know, of 1,000 kids, that's a lot of kids who've had a suicide attempt in the previous year and required medical attention, right? A couple of things that happened, a couple of reasons, or one reason that students end up feeling suicidal is something we talk a lot about, or hear a lot about probably, is bullying. Some folks are actually from South Hadley here, and you know, I'm sure many people are aware of that case. But it's not unique to South Hadley or to this part of Massachusetts, or you know, or really anywhere. You hear about these incidents arising all the time. The bullying, you know, if you think about it in terms of risk, the intensity of the pain that is experienced from the bullying and from the harassment that comes from that exceeds the resources that are available, at least the perceived resources that are available to help manage that. And for adolescents, that's an important factor to consider. That, you know, how do they feel like they can reach out when they're being bullied? How do, as a clinician, if you're working with adolescents, how do you engage them in asking questions around that particular risk factor? Because sometimes, oftentimes, they don't want to talk about it. They're embarrassed by it. They're ashamed by it. They're afraid of what would happen if they talk about it, because what are the consequences? Are they going to get beat up? Are they going to get, you know, what's next for them? So it becomes sort of closeted. Like a lot of things in adolescence, it becomes closeted. But it is a significant risk factor in adolescence particularly. Well, there's even a pushback amongst adolescent peers to talk about bullying, because it seems to be so much in the news now that there's this reluctance to even acknowledge that bullying is occurring. Oh, everybody talks about bullying. That's not bullying. That's something else, right? Well, it is bullying. And it's important, if you're working with kids, to really be clear about what it means to be bullied and what that actually is. Yes, maybe you can call it harassment, but it is bullying. And if you're being picked on and it feels like it's not in your control, then you're right. So it becomes a leadership issue within the school to promote that culture. Exactly, yeah. So another group that I really want to highlight is LGBT youth. I just found this study. It was just published last week. It's data from 2011. This is in San Francisco. The San Francisco School District did a study, and they interviewed, there were about 2,500 non-LGB students, 106 LGB, and 33 trans individuals who identified as transgendered. So you can see around some of the violence that might promote, the bullying that might promote suicidal risk, or sort of exacerbation of stress and mental illness. 33% of non-LGBT students had property damage at school. 70% of transgendered students been bullied at school. 20% versus 66%. Been in a fight. 70%. Been threatened or injured with a weapon at school. 58%. So then you go to students that have had suicidal indicators. So sad, depressed, seriously consider suicide, made a plan, attempted suicide, and suicide attempt with injury. And you can see, again, in the LGBT students, pretty significant increase over the non-LGBT students. Suicide indicators, seriously considered suicide, made a suicide plan, attempted suicide. So, and you're right, the N for the transgender students particularly is small, But it's clearly an area of attention when you're working with adolescents. And this is just, this is really suicide risk. This, we're not even talking about non-suicidal self-injurious behavior. So I guess the point is that, again, resources available to adolescents who identify as LGBT, very important to ask questions around what resources are in place or exist for them to help with the feelings that they have that they're struggling with. So let's talk about non-suicidal self-injurious behaviors for a minute. I'm going to just have, you can just pass these around, that'd be great. So between 33 and 50% of adolescents in the United States have done some form of non-suicidal self-injurious behavior. What's the most common?
Cutting.
Cutting, right. Burning is actually, interestingly, sort of on the rise in terms of self-injurious behavior. Doing sort of self-tattooing. I don't know if people have seen that, but that's certainly something that's been on the rise. It's often, self-injurious behavior is often impulsive. It usually happens with less than an hour of planning. More impulsive than even suicidal behavior. Suicidal behavior typically takes some more planning than non-suicidal self-injurious behavior. Adolescents who injure themselves report that they don't feel, they feel little or no pain, partly because one of the factors involved in self-injurious behavior is to get rid of the emotional pain that they're feeling. So what they'll say is, I cut myself and I didn't feel any pain, I just felt relief. That relief, when I saw myself bleeding, I knew I was real, I felt grounded. So it's often not, in most cases, it's not an attempt to commit suicide or to even injure oneself seriously enough to end up in the hospital. It's really to either ground oneself or to regulate affect. In some cases, it's about getting attention. Self-harm in peers is a risk factor because of the contagion effect. We talked about that earlier. So I don't know if you've seen this in schools, but it's certainly in middle schools, all over, I've seen it where students will begin to talk about it. They'll begin to act on the self, or they'll begin to self-injure, and then other students join in. And it's almost like a pact, sort of this cult contagion effect that occurs. It's around, in some cases, belonging to a peer group. It's around identity, and so often that happens. Although it's typically kind of fleeting. It goes in kind of waxes and wanes. Often, you know, you can see it happening with the level of stress that occurs at different times during the school year. Things become more stressful around the holidays. You're going to see more likely to see more self-injurious behavior, and then that wanes as the year goes on, and then may increase again towards the end of the school year. There's a 2007 study that really reports there's no gender difference in self-injurious behavior. Although we often think of self-injurious behavior as being more likely to occur with women, statistically that's not true. One of the things that is true is that men are less likely to report self-injurious behavior. They're less likely to do it as part of a contagion identity kind of process, but they are just as likely to self-injure as women are. On that particular study, they did. I don't remember how it played out. I'm trying to remember because this is from a couple of years ago when I did the research, but I think men were more likely to self-harm in ways other than cutting, burning, headbanging, other things,
punching walls
that would be more likely to not be happening with women. Women were much more likely to cut. Yeah, and you know, you could even say that some of the, you know, self-injurious behavior is you know, things like you know, these kind of fight clubs that form, right? Boys fighting each other to the point where they're seriously injured is really self-injurious. You know, you're putting yourself in that position. While you're being injured by somebody else, it's still sort of self-injury by proxy almost, right? My recollection of the studies that I looked at, there was not a socioeconomic difference. But that's, you know, that's, I don't know more than that. But I do remember that I was sort of surprised, because you do think of self-injurious behavior being reported more, at least in sort of a private school, upper echelon, kind of upper middle class folks. But again, I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. It may be reported more, but the incidents, I think, are across the board the same.
And race?
Race, I don't know about. Good question. Yeah. Favazza said that non-self-injurious behavior is a morbid form of self-help, which is different than suicidal behavior. You know, truly suicidal behavior isn't really a form of self-help. It's a form of ending one's self. Where suicidal, non-suicidal self-injurious behavior really is, in some ways, trying to either help oneself or get help, get attention. So why do people self-injure? One reason is for affect regulation. So, you know, being able to manage anxiety, managing anger, frustration, depression, right? So when one has intolerable affect or intolerable emotions, self-injuring is a way to manage that. You think of, well, boys, good example of what boys do. What do? They punch the door, they punch the wall, right, when they're angry. That helps them manage that anger. They are actually able to take that out, or their feelings are actually physically manifested. Controlling feelings and cognitions, so distracting from problems. Stopping suicidal thoughts, dissociation, or stopping dissociation. So those are other reasons why someone would self-injure. And then self-punishment, so that sort of the feeling shame and hurting oneself because they feel ashamed. And for girls, I've seen that particularly, but I think boys are the same. And then there's also the interpersonal piece, wanting to be involved with a peer group, sort of getting care and attention from folks, from parents or others. So if one self-injures, then they get attention for that. You know, certainly there's a part of the contagion effect that's around being part of a peer group and feeling that they're accepted into a peer group. In this case, it's to control the feelings of shame. So someone feels incredibly ashamed for something that they've done, and when they self-injure, that helps. It changes the focus of the shame. So the attention for that individual that's self-harming goes to the self-injury versus the whatever the event was that precipitated the shame. Now, that's not to say then that after they cut, they don't feel ashamed of that, because often they do. And so it becomes kind of a cycle of self-defeating behavior. But the reason for the self-injurious behavior is to help lessen the feeling of shame of something they participated in. There's clearly reasons why this works, right? I mean, people have been, there's documentation of self-injury going back to the times of the Egyptians, right? There was an Egyptian king that self-injured, and there's a lot that's been written about his self-injurious behavior. So, and probably even, you know, further back in history, people have suffered. Well, there's a reason for that, right? I mean, people do actually feel relief when they self-injure. It really, you know, there is that chemical release that of endorphins that helps people feel grounded and helps them feel real. So it's important to acknowledge that. But it also is very important to recognize that you're right, as the self-injurious behavior continues, you have to increase it to get the same high from it. It's like a cocaine addiction that, you know, you can start out using a little bit of a cocaine and feel really good, but down the road, it's much more serious. And that's all about the dopamine and the endorphins release. So, yeah, you know, that is true. I also think that, and there's something that goes along with that, rites of passage and rituals. So, you know, part of the cutting and part of the self-injurious behavior is ritualistic, right? Mm-hmm. And again, just like doing drugs, the ritual of preparing for the cutting, the ritual of, you know, involved around the self-injurious behavior actually triggers a lot of the same feelings that one has when they start to prepare the heroin, right? They get that kind of rush, that high, from the expectation of it. So right, part of what we have to look at is how do you replace those rituals? You know, what can be provided that that works for them in a way that is not so you know, potentially devastating to them. All right, moving on. So in terms of, this is not amazing news, what do you do? How do you assess for non-suicidal self-injurious behavior? Well, it's really important to think about the nature and the quality of important relationships for that person. You know, are the relationships that they're involved in supportive, or are they punitive? Does the person, the patient, need to influence or manipulate others in order to feel like they're getting the sort of attention and support and compassion in the relationship? And is, you know, is the nature of this, of the self-injurious behavior related to that wanting to be or needing to be connected or getting attention? Does the person have a history of being abandoned in relationships? Is he or she predisposed with concerns about abandonment? That's a factor in sort of the assessment of self-injurious behavior, because there are qualities about folks who self-injure often have that sort of sense of abandonment. Right? Other things to think about: are there recent events that that the patient has had that may be considered traumatic? So are they, you know, in this case with the tattooing, that's certainly a culturally acceptable way of self-injuring, more so now than probably it ever has been, right? Or at least in recent history in this culture. But it's, you know, that how is self-injurious behavior being used to manage the feelings related to trauma? So is there shame that's unremitting? That's something to consider when you're assessing for self-injurious behavior. Something that the person's been able to discuss with another individual. This, you know, if you have somebody that you're talking with, then you're likely to be expressing the feelings to another versus taking it out on yourself. And then what's the nature and the quality of the coping skills? Do they have culturally egosyntonic appropriate coping skills to be able to manage the feelings that they have? So I gave you a list of acronyms for kind of what to think about when you're assessing in terms of self-injurious behavior. You want to think about grounding in reality. Is the person grounded in reality, or can you help them be grounded in reality? Are they escaping from feelings from depression, shame, or guilt? Are they using the self-injurious behavior to ease tension that they're experiencing, or the stresses that they're experiencing? Are they using it to stop bad feelings? Are they doing it for an emotional release? If they're doing it for any of those reasons, then probably what they're then they're using the self-injurious behavior for affect regulation. If they're doing the self-injurious behavior as a reaction to or from others, if they're using it for attention seeking, if they're using it to gain power or status in their peer group, they're using it to exert a sense of control over their own body, or if they use it to divert attention from other issues, then the reason for the self-injurious behavior is likely to be around issues of control. And then if they're using it for coping with alienation, alerting others of their need for support, validation of feelings, or expressing emotional pain, then the self-injurious behavior is really about what they're communicating or wanting to communicate something that they're unable to communicate in other ways. So, you know, the affect regulation, the control, communication. Okay, so it's for those three reasons, the affect regulation, the control, and the communication. Those are the areas that you're really wanting to assess. What's the reason for the behavior? What is it that bringing up the need for the self-injurious behavior that the person's engaging in? Are they trying to control others or control something about themselves? Are they trying to regulate affect, or are they communicating something that they're unable to communicate in another way?